I'm Sean Graham, and what's oldest news this week is the Empress of Asia. A lot of people know, of course, the CPR for its railway operations across Canada, but what is lesser known is the CPR's sea operations. It had a network of ships that sailed all around the world, transporting people and goods from Canada to other countries and people from other countries to Canada. And the Empress of Asia was one of these ships. It was commissioned in 1913, ultimately served in the First World War, then was retrofitted again, served as passenger and freight in the 1920s, 1930s, and then ultimately served in the Second World War before it was sank. But it was a piece of history of the CPR that showed how important shipping was at that time, goes through the various ebbs and flows of shipping through that first half of the 20th century. And it is the subject of a new book by Dan Black entitled Oceans of Fate, Peace and Peril Aboard the Steamship Empress of Asia. And what's very interesting and good about this book is that Dan looks at the ship not so much as the physical ship and the hull and what that means and the operations of the ship, but rather the people who came aboard, who was on board the ship early on when it was used for passenger and freight, and then how was it used during the First World War, particularly when you think of the Chinese Labor Corps and the Empress of Asia transported members of the Chinese Labor Corps from China to Canada, and then goes back into passenger service in the 1920s, 1930s, then again as a warship in the Second World War. So he traces the ship's history not so much from an operational perspective, but from a human perspective, and looks at the individuals who are on board. It's a really great way, I think, to look at an object, particularly an object that is very transitory, both in where it is physically, but also the individuals who are using it, who are on board and who have a relationship with the ship. So a really wonderful approach. Dan's been on the show before, back when it was the History Slam, talking about the Chinese Labor Corps. So it was really great to have him back. He's a former editor of Legion Magazine, has written multiple books, is very good in this space, and really knows how to tell a story. So I'm very pleased to see that this book is on the verge of being publicly available, as it is being released next Tuesday, February the 18th. So to get you a little intrigued, get you excited about the book, I was fortunate to talk to Dan a little bit earlier. Very much enjoyed it as always, and I think you will as well. So let's get right into my chat with Dan Black. All right, and Dan Black joins me now. Dan, how are you today?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing, Sean?
Doing really well. Very happy to speak with you again, this time about Oceans of Fate, Peace and Peril Aboard the Steamship Empress of Asia. So before we get into some of the specifics of the ship and the book, what struck you about this ship that you wanted to write a book about it? What was the intro point to you for this project?
Well, it's a really good question, Sean. I was looking for a ship that had service in both world wars, so the first and the second, but also had this other part of her personality where she served as a passenger liner. Now there were many ships, I suppose, that could say that that's what they did during that time period. I selected her, I guess, primarily because she was a registered Canadian ship. And but as the project got going, my publisher was encouraging me to, you know, yeah, it's important it's Canadian registered, but they were more interested in where the story was going in terms of the people. So the Asia was very much a ship that seemed to answer those, check those boxes for me. And the other aspect of it, Sean, is honestly the last book, the Harry Livingston's book, the Asia was deployed with the Chinese Labor Corps. Mm-hmm. And as I got to know the Asia in that story, I learned some things that I thought, yeah, that's interesting, but is there enough? Is there enough to tell a story? And I didn't want to tell an operational history. I wanted to, about a ship, I wanted to tell a human story, and that's what I was after.
And that's the interesting part about this book. And when you look at, say, the official histories that come out of the Department of National Defense, which is where I now fully employed, I could say that those ones are not always about the people, the old ones. They are very much about the ships, where they were at a given time, what was the order given. And that's when I first saw this, I thought, is this what this book is about? But it really isn't. It's really a story of the people who happened to be on the ship. And I'm wondering, is as you do the research for something like this, as you're writing this book, how do you actually conceive of the ship, right? Because it is a story about people. And the only constant, though, throughout the entirety of the 30 years that you're writing about is the hull and the metal. But it's very much a story about the people. So how do you kind of come to terms with those two things?
Well, I think it's the ship is the platform, but in order to convey what the passengers experienced, I think the reader has to have a really good understanding of the vessel they were on. And yeah, you know, I could have written about a number of vessels, but with this one, you know, I was again really struck with the fact that it was built as a new, brand new passenger liner, and it was a sister ship to the Empress of Russia, and it just seemed to sort of be something, a platform that needed to carry through the story so that the reader could appreciate really how these ships functioned and some of the challenges that the crew faced on board. You know, it was the age of coal too, so everybody sort of doesn't like the idea of coal anymore, but back then that was the fuel, and so there that had to be told. And the ship, as a matter of fact, the nature of the ship, because it was coal fired, that sort of brings us to one of the main controversies in the story, and that was the inability of the ship to maintain speed, not because of a mechanical issue. It was more because of the challenges in the stokehold that they faced, and the book goes into that in great length. And some are convinced it contributed to her loss off of Singapore. But so the ship itself, the mechanics of the ship and the way it functioned is very key, I think, because it helps explain how these people on board were dealing with things as they came up.
So to get us started, the ship, you know, it launches in 1913, or commissioned in 1913. It strikes me and I'm not certainly a shipping expert or an expert on ships by any means, but it strikes me that from what I've read about the era, this is still the era of romance of steamships. And, you know, the Titanic has sunk at this point, but there's still this idea of the romance of the large steamship, the ocean liners. How does the Empress of Asia, or really maybe even just this class of ship, fit into this era of shipping around the world?
Well, that's another good question. The Empress of Asia, when it was built and completed in 1913, what happened? It was considered state of the art. Like it could do its average or regular service speed was to be 18.5 knots, but it actually could exceed that. It could go over 20 knots, which in the day was a fairly fast ship, and that was thanks to the new engineering that came up. How did it apply to the era? The era really dictated the construction of the ship, because that was the age of people, the romance of foreign travel, and the Canadian Pacific had its great red route, which brought passengers from the UK across to Canada through the CPR and then on the ships again over to the Far East. It was the way to travel. It was the most popular tourist thing to do around that time. Aircraft travel wasn't really going on at that point. So that's what it was. And so what they did is the Arrow 2 had this expectation of class. There was first class, second class, and then of course there was steerage. But even by this time, the conditions in steerage had improved immensely from what they had been in the age of sail. I mean, they weren't the same situation, but they had come up. But in terms of the first and second class passengers, they really had an expectation that when they bought a ticket on a ship like the Empress of Asia, that they would be treated well, that the accommodations, the cabins would be fantastic, that the food would be, you know, like five-star restaurant food, not so much in second class, but certainly in first class. So there were a lot of people that really saw this as the way to go, and And it wasn't, it was a way to get from A to B, but it was also a way to mix with other people, the wealthy, people went away, but they partied on these ships too. They had fun in the ballrooms and they danced and they reached a destination. So it was kind of today we talk about passenger service and we see people going and taking Caribbean cruises and things like that. But this was different. This was more a situation where it was purposeful business travel, but there was also purposeful tourism travel, and they wanted to see the world.
Right, because a lot of cruises are circles, essentially, right? You start in one port and go for a week and come back to the same port. There's a transportation aspect to this as well. How many people roughly in the first configuration, right, when it launches? What was a typical hold for people, or the number of people that would travel on the ship?
Well, it's interesting. The maiden voyage in 1913 had not very many passengers because it just was such a novelty. And plus it came out of Govan, Scotland, and then went to Liverpool to pick up its first passengers for its maiden voyage. And the book quotes a number, but it wasn't very high. I was surprised by that. But it had like 500 crew. So the crew really outnumbered the passengers at that time. And there's also a lot of things going on at this time too, about who did what jobs on the ships and what countries they came from originally. So it was quite lopsided, but by the time the ship did her maiden voyage and came back around across the Pacific into Vancouver, the number of passengers on board had grown quite significantly. I can't quote the exact number here, but there was, a good size passenger list when she reached Vancouver at the end, because people had boarded in South Africa, Durban and Hong Kong, Shanghai.
And what was the rough configuration? Because the book gets into not only the people who are on board, but what it's carrying as well. Its role is shipping things around the world as well. So just roughly, how did the company balance the need to transport people versus the need to transport stuff?
Oh, I think it was very important for the Canadian Pacific. They really counted on cargo and both ways across the Pacific. Passenger service paid for a lot of it, but there was a lot of important cargo coming across, like raw silk. There was one consignment, I think, of $8 million worth of raw silk that came in on the Asia. And then they had to unload it rather quickly in Vancouver and get it by special train across the country to eastern markets. This was the raw silk. Some of it was destined further afield to Europe. But so the Asia was very key on that, and it would, you name it, there was lots of different cargo, from fruit to hard cargo it was quite a long list of different things. And people did have occasion. It's interesting. There was occasion where people did manage to slip some opium on board and bring it across. And so the authorities in Vancouver were trying to keep an eye on that as well. But yeah, it was busy.
So of course, 1913, when it takes its maiden voyage, that's a year before the outbreak of the First World War. So how long is it before the ship gets repurposed or starts to be included in wartime activities?
No, it was very quick. So the maiden voyage started in June of 1913. It reaches home, I think it is in August 31st of 1913. And then in 1914, on August the 3rd, 1914, she's requisitioned for war duty to be deployed in the South China Sea around the Philippines, doing embargo stuff. And then also over to the Indian Ocean, where she chased the very notorious German light cruiser, the Emden. Evidence that she came very, very close to the Emden, but it was the Australian warship Sydney that actually took the Emden out in the Indian Ocean. But she was very much on the lookout for that very incredible German ship that had, wreaked a lot of havoc in that area. And then right after that, which was surprising to me, really surprising to me, and it took a lot of research, was the fact that she was then deployed to the Red Sea. She went to Aden, which was a British protectorate, and her job there was to join a number of other ships that were on the lookout for dhows smuggling arms and things into the Ottoman Empire, the enemy. And so there was, that was an interesting period, although it doesn't stand out as that she did anything super, super great there, but she did overall, with in conjunction with other ships, she was able to sort of keep things, keep an eye on things. And who knows, you know, a patrol can happen and the people on board might say, well, we didn't do anything very much, but overall the scope and the presence of patrols, you know, you could argue did make a difference. So she did that. And then she came back into a more regular passenger service in late 1915. And that's when, you know, she, from that point on, between there and 1918, she was transporting members of the Chinese Labor Corps across the Pacific again. So, yeah, she was deployed the day before the First World War broke out. She was called to duty.
For that period where it's deployed, before it starts transporting members of the Chinese Labor Corps, who's staffing the ship? Yeah, because I'm curious about that question, because you go from, you know, first class five-star service to people who are there in more of a service capacity and doing these patrols.
That's right. I mean, she took on a British officer to there were two British officers that came into play during that period I described. Although Captain Robinson, the ship's first master who took it on her maiden voyage, Captain Samuel Robinson, he was on board and he elected to stay with the ship during her wartime duties. So did an executive officer named Herbert James. And Herbert James and Robinson both left amazing journals and really great stuff that I was able to tap into. And but you're right, when she was under war service in the First World War, it was definitely British officers that were in charge, which didn't always fit well with Captain Robinson, because he had to give up his ship and he didn't really want to do that.
Yeah, captains tend to be very protective of their ships. It's very true. Now, one thing that I have read a lot of over the years are accounts from sailors, people in the Navy, writing about the conditions aren't usually the most comfortable on naval vessels, but here you have a ship that was designed for passenger service. Like, were any of the people who were stationed on the ship, was this in that first year of the war maybe considered a nice place to have to be deployed?
I don't think so, because although she did maintain her grand piano in the lounge, she did have that still, because they played it one night during a church service coming across the South China Sea. But no, generally speaking, what happened when it was, once she was requisitioned in 1914, what happened was things were torn out of her and she was converted into this armed merchant cruiser role. And so a lot of the nice creature comforts of home disappeared. In fact, Herbert James, who I mentioned earlier, who left the wonderful journal, he described some of these things being taken off the ship. And it was quite sad for these guys to see this happen, because they had just been on her when she was a passenger ship. So yeah, no, it wasn't the same type of comfortable vessel when those guys got on board.
So does that for you change the way people are writing about the ship and the way maybe they're interacting even with each other, compared to, you know, that first voyage? You got people in the various classes who are there in the social element, as you were talking about, to now people are there in this military capacity or on patrols. Does that, I would imagine that changes their relationship with the ship, the way they see the ship, but does it change the way that people are interacting with each other around the ship and the way that they're writing about it?
Yeah, they, you know, Herbert James in his diary, he does comment on the fact that there's some people on board that don't know what they're doing. Right. They in addition to refitting the ship in Hong Kong, a lot of the Chinese crew left. And there's reasons for that. But what happened was they had to suddenly recruit more people to come on board. And not all of them really had much shipborne experience, right? So Herbert James comments in his diary about some of the challenges they had about that in terms of when they were on patrol, especially around the Philippines. So the relationships were, that's a good point, because the relationships became more serious. They became, it wasn't like, oh, look at that lovely view. It was more about, we have to do this or we could, you know, be targeted and we may not get through this. So, and there's a lovely passage in there from Robinson who talks about the ship being incredibly vulnerable to the German squadron, Asiatic squadron that they were on the lookout for at that time. And and of course the ship would black out at night. There were no lights, so it was very dark. So you're right. There was more of a, how do I describe it? There was more of a serious overall tone to being on that ship. It wasn't gay or full of entertainments at all. I mean, they weren't, you know, holding masquerade parties and big dances in the ballroom. They were probably sleeping in, you know, more rudimentary quarters and dealing with the threat that was all that, you know, could have always been out there.
And then you mentioned that the ship becomes part of the transportation network for the Chinese Labor Corps. And we will refer people to that book, that book. You could read about the ship and its role there in Dan's book about the Chinese Labor Corps. So once the war is over and the ship can now be repurposed again, what was that process like to take it from war service, getting it back to a condition that was acceptable to travelers for passengers in the 1920s?
Well, that's a good thing you pointed out there. When she first came out of the First World War, you know, people could see her dazzle still. There were parts of her, that dazzle, that camouflage they used to put on ships back then. But it didn't take long because they knew they were going back into trying to sell passenger tickets. So they painted her up. They did a wonderful job. They got her all looking very good. She was kind of resplendent in white. As I whenever I see a picture of her of that era, she was beautiful. She was and most people that looked at her, this was finally what she was built for. Like, she had that interrupted period, but now she's back. She looks like she's supposed to be doing what she's supposed to be doing. So it was 16,000, her gross tonnage was 16,909. So she was a fairly big ship, three stacker, and her had these, the smokestacks were kind of a buff color, so they looked quite nice. And she had a nice little boot topping around her freeboard. And yeah, she looked really quite stunning when she came into port. Most people would look at her and think, well, she could never sink. You know, how could she float? Let alone, but she was quite immense. And some of the people that I interviewed for the book that traveled on her in that period, including a young Chinese boy, he was 9 years old, who was basically leaving China to come and live in North America. There's a wonderful moment there where he's standing on the wharf in Hong Kong, staring up at this massive ship, and he can't fathom the size of her. I think he relates her to, I think she looks similar to the sacred mountain near his village. Mm-hmm. And so there's this stunning realization of how enormous this ship is. She was not the biggest ship at the time, but a big one. Yeah.
And who was going on the ship? Like, what kind of the clientele was the Empress of Asia attracting at this time?
Well, she was always selling, you know, first class and second class tickets, you know, the first class to the wealthy, and second class more, you know, to middle class and above, sort of thing, I guess you look at today. But there were a lot of people that boarded and went into steerage, into the third class level down below. And as I said earlier, that quality of steerage had improved. When people hear the word steerage, they automatically think, an awful setting. But in this day, the Canadian Pacific put a lot of work into making sure that the steerage area, or the third class area, which it later became known as, actually, it's interesting, originally, the steerage was actually, on drawings that I found, was known as Oriental steerage. That's what they called it, and it was amazing to see that on the blueprints. But it had improved, and it got a little bit better as time went on. And I don't know if that answers your question, but they were doing they realized that it had to do something, because that's where the money was. It was passengers and getting them across. So
was it still doing everything in the Pacific, west coast of Canada, into Asia?
Yeah, its primary route, well, its only route really during that period, the 20s and the 30s, was across the Pacific. And it took the Great Circle route. So, you know, when you look at a map, it didn't cut right across. It went up around the Aleutians, or towards the Aleutians, and down. And its first stop going across the Pacific was the Yokohama, so near Tokyo. And then it would travel from there down to usually to Kobe, Japan, and then around to Nagasaki, where it would coal. The ship burned about, with its average service speed, the ship of 18 and a half knots, the ship burned about 311 tons of coal a day. So it needed good coal, and it needed coaling stations. And Nagasaki was one of the big ones. Vancouver was another big place for it to get that fuel from. So that, then from Nagasaki, it would usually head across to Shanghai. And if not, go in, right into Shanghai, you know, park outside Shanghai on the Wusan River there, and Yangtze. And then it would come out and go down to Hong Kong. And then often from there, it wouldn't necessarily go to Singapore from Hong Kong, but then it would often go across. Sometimes it would go across to the Philippines. And later, as the book shows, the Canadian Pacific realized, well, Hawaii should be on this list. So Hawaii was added later. Mm-hmm.
Is there any contention about the ship doing this route, given this is a time where there's still a lot of tension surrounding immigration to Canada from Japan, from China? Does the ship, is it viewed by some as facilitating that? And does it have any sort of negative press about it? Or do people point to ships like it that are doing this route that are contributing to immigration patterns that some in Canada, some people in power and people across the country were adamantly opposed to?
I didn't come across any, interesting question. I didn't come across any documents that specifically stated that, pointed a finger at the ships. Of course, it's probably true that a lot of people were anti-immigration at that time. Clearly they were. Especially if you were from Southeast Asia. And Canada, of course, had the $500 head tax in place, which was applied certainly by the time the ship was in service. Chinese passengers would have to pay that head tax. And so there's a whole chapter in the book called Ship to Shore, which talks about weaves the stories of a few Chinese people coming across, and some of the challenges they had to face once they came ashore. The challenges, I didn't come across anything, any evidence of challenges on board the ship. There were some passengers. You have to be careful how I word this, because there were some passengers that, let's say from the U.S., that were going to China or to Japan, crossing to Japan. And one of the diaries I came across notes that when they went on a tour of the ship, how they noticed that, in her words, how the colors changed from when they went from the top deck down into steerage as part of this tour. But I didn't come across anything specifically that was written about anything negative about the ship doing this. I'm sure it probably exists, but I didn't find anything like that. It was mostly, again, when the passengers get off the ship, that they had to pass through immigration. And particularly if you were a young woman, there's a story of a young woman in the book who gets off, wanted to land at Victoria, but she couldn't because there was a gale going on. So the ship had to forego that and go directly to Vancouver. And then she was eventually shuttled back over to Victoria, and it was in Victoria Harbor, which I'll be visiting in March, actually, for a book tour. She was married, had to be married on the wharf in a hut or a shed on the wharf, because she, the understanding, at least from her family, was that if she didn't get married, she wouldn't be allowed to continue on in Canada. So she arranged a paper marriage, and got married, and then left that fellow, and then crossed to Vancouver and lived a very successful life in Vancouver. And so there's stories like that, but I can't put my finger on anything where somebody actually wrote and said, we can't allow ships like the Empress of Asia to do this.
I'm interested too in the types of individuals who are on the ship, because that's a great story about this woman coming over, getting married, living a successful life. But as you said earlier, there's also people who are using the ship for tourism and to go back and forth to just see the world. People who have a lot of money and are going off on these trips, whereas for other people, it's quite literally a bridge between two lives, essentially. Your life in one place, and you're moving somewhere else, and you have a life in a different place. In the material that you've seen, the people who are writing about it, or even the people who you've talked to about the ship, do they relate to it differently based on what their purpose was, why they were on the ship? Did they have a different relationship with the ship, but also potentially its fellow passengers?
Yeah, well, there's a woman from the States, from Missouri, Joplin, Missouri. Her name was Mary. What's her last name? Anyway, Mary McNeil. She traveled with her husband Henry, and he was a machine. He owned a machine company in the States, and they went with a little bit of a family world tour. And when they got on the ship, Mary became the family scribe, and she would keep notes about this journey across the Pacific. And you could tell reading her diary that she was really into this. And her daughter Helen was on board with her, and so Mary was always looking after her daughter Helen, who was an older adult, but still keeping an eye out for her. They talked about feeling seasick, the relationship with the sea, seeing beautiful sunsets. There's, you know, some things like that. But when they had the tour of the ship, as I mentioned a little earlier, they were Mary in particular was quite taken with the ship and its capabilities, how it could desalinate water and the incredible engine room, and the galley. The galley really impressed her. She comments about dishwashers and everything that fairly modern galley. So she was quite impressed overall by the ship. And of course the captain would sometimes, or his executive officer, come down and explain things to everybody. But
So once we get into the 1930s, of course, Great Depression happens. And is there a noticeable change in the ship and perhaps the passengers who are able to afford transportation on the ship once we get into the 1930s?
Yeah, the passenger cargo dropped off. It took a while for the Depression to really grab hold. I mean, it didn't happen in 29, the real obvious negative effects. They sort of came with that shipping, at least to the Empress of Asia. They seemed to really take hold in 1930-31. Was when they noticed a significant drop in cargo shipping across, which affected the Canadian Pacific's revenue stream for sure. Passengers changed somewhat. I mean, there were still people. I was surprised by there were still people getting on board and going to Japan, going to China. And what astounded me about that, Sean, was that at the time, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book this way, is this was a very tumultuous period. Not only did we have the Great Depression, but we had lots of things going on, lots of upheaval and violence occurring in China. And still people would go across and do this. There were also, and I was really glad to find this too, there was also some amazing journalism going on. There was an American journalist who went over and came back several times, and he would be preparing his stories during this time. And so the passenger in the 20s, it seemed more like people were traveling for the good of travel, for the fun of travel. In the 1930s, there was just so many things happening that there seemed to be more people that were traveling for business purposes, and most of it was geared to a lot of it was geared towards journalism, journalists traveling back and forth, and business people trying to protect their interests, of course. So there was a it was a interesting period.
Is there an earlier change to the ship's itinerary or routes based on the outbreak of the Second Sino-Japanese War? We think of course the Second World War starting in 1939, but as you say, there's a lot of turmoil and tumult in the region throughout the 1930s, but certainly the outbreak of that conflict specifically, given the ports that you're talking about, I would imagine it had an impact on the routes.
It did. Well, the routes kind of the routes mostly stayed the same, but what often happened is the ship could be suddenly called to duty. So for evacuation purposes, and the book goes into how that happened in Shanghai, where the ship had to, it was in Hong Kong at the time, and it had to steam quickly to outside of Shanghai to the go to anchor on the Yangtze outside the Wusan River there. And then all these evacuees were pouring out of Shanghai at the time, and they got on board, and so the ship served as a kind of a evacuation vessel, and it steamed to down to Hong Kong with all these survivors. And so there's some really good stuff in the book about that, that talks about individuals that got on board at that point, but that was a clear case of the ship being reassigned, if you will, by they got both reassigned by Canadian Pacific, but also the British were saying, "Now, could you go and pick up these people?" Sort of thing. So that was a sort of like an emergency relief situation. She also evacuated Russian refugees, and many of those came to Canada and settled on the West. So she had this purpose. And of course, when the Great Kanto earthquake happened in Yokohama, she was used to. Wasn't at Yokohama when the earthquake hit, but it was called again in to carry refugees to Vancouver.
And then once we get into the Second World War, we get into 1939, how long does it take for it to be repurposed to specifically for war service again?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Just before that, the Asia was steaming off of Japan. It was 1940, a full year before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. So this is 1940, September 1940, and Japanese aircraft bomb her while she's steaming towards Yokohama. And the story goes that the Japanese maintained it was an accident, that they dropped these bombs by accident, that they were engaged in some sort of a target practice thing going on. But a lot of the passengers on board who were quoted in the press at the time of saying it was no accident because the bomb straddled the ship. But I leave it up to the reader to decide that. But I did present enough information to show that event did happen, and it became somewhat of an international incident. The Canadian government got involved, and so that was before the ship was requisitioned again for war service. And I just want to quote you the date here of that. It was... So it would have been formally, the Empress of Asia would have been formally commissioned or requisitioned for war service on January the 13th, 1941. It became a troop ship. And what happened then is it sailed to Liverpool, and it picked up members of the Green Howards, a British unit, and transported them to the Suez, which was an interesting trip. And it's interesting too, just to back up a little bit there, is the Chinese crew that had done such a good job steaming the ship were let go. And the ship took on stokehold or members that had worked in the stokeholds of ships and engine rooms of ships on the Great Lakes. And so those folks took the train out to Vancouver, and they were the ones that steamed the ship around to Liverpool through the Panama Canal. And they did an amazing job, considering that they were only was limited to Great Lakes experience. So, but they did a really good job. And that, but at Liverpool, they left the ship, and the ship took on new members of the stokehold from Liverpool. And not all those individuals had a lot of sea time. And that's when that was the beginning of when things started to unravel in the engine room. Anyway, that first trip, it went around to Suez and dropped off members of the Green Howards who were serving in North Africa, bound for North Africa campaign. And then it picked up, one of the people it picked up there was Prince Philip, very young Prince Philip. It's interesting. I actually wrote to his father, told him about this, thinking I would not get a response, and I got a letter back from the palace. So, wow. Anyway, so Prince Philip gets on board, but also a number of wartime evacuees, men, women, and children who had escaping wartime Europe, and then it also transported hundreds of Italian prisoners of war. And it brought them back to Durban. So it went south to the Red Sea to Durban, dropped them off at Durban. And in addition to, and also Prince Philip, that's where he got off. And he served as a midshipman on the Asia, by the way. Got a wonderful picture of him on the ship. So anyway, after that, the ship traveled to Trinidad and then up to New York, where the New York press dubbed the ship the Ark of War, because it had all these evacuees on board. And it was a fairly big moment. It was, I think, one of the first ships that had come back from Europe with evacuees on board. And then from there up to Halifax, where it actually was in a convoy, the first American escorted convoy of the war, HX-150. And it, again, crossed the Atlantic, dangerous crossing, crossed the Atlantic, back to Liverpool, and then it commenced its final voyage from Liverpool, which took it again back around as far as Durban. And then at Durban, because Pearl Harbor had occurred at that time, it was then from Durban dispatched to Bombay, India, to pick up more British troops. And they didn't know where they were going at that point, but eventually it became clear that they were going to Singapore, which was under siege. It was, things were going badly there. So, and that's really the last leg of her life. She was attacked twice going into Singapore.
Now, you mentioned earlier that the speed of the ship might have played a part in its ultimate sinking. So how does that play out in the sinking, and why does the speed of the ship, and perhaps going a little slower than its max capability, how does that play into the events that ultimately led to its destruction?
Yeah, well, you know, when it, on that first trip where it went to the Suez, picked up Prince Philip, and then went back around and up to New York City, it did have the same issues there. Off Africa, it did fall behind in convoy, and a number of people commented on that, and they're quoted in the book. When it went in, so to get to Singapore, instead of going through the Malacca Strait, they went around Sumatra and then up between Sumatra and Java through the Sunda Strait, not far from where that Krakatoa is, where the, and it went up through the Sunda Strait. It joined another convoy there, and then after it got through the Sunda Strait, the convoy split up. Some ships went to Batavia, which is now Jakarta, and then the rest steamed towards Singapore. And they were troop ships, all of them. The Asia had the most number of troops on board. It had 2,235 British troops. And it had also a very large crew of over 400. Mm-hmm. So as it was going in through there, and what happened is the same problem arose again. The ship fell behind in convoy, and people were getting really nervous in the Banca Strait because enemy aircraft showed up and started to try to take out the ship. And it was last in line. And the other ships were ahead of it. And there was one ship, a British warship, that came close, went back and said, "You got to pick up speed. You're going to get hit." And so that's clearly what happened. And then you had an eyewitness, a young Canadian named Hoskin, who wrote a remarkable diary. And he witnessed, in his diary, he says he witnessed members of the Stokehold coming up out of the ship to topside to get out. They were scared, according to him, but they came up. But he was very angry that he witnessed this. So he was an eyewitness of that. There were a number of British troops on board that were eyewitness to that. Oddly enough, one of the crew members I interviewed, who passed away 2 years ago, Morris Atkins, he was a young officer cadet on the bridge. And I asked him specifically if he noticed this happening. And he said, "I didn't see it. I didn't see any of that." And then I asked him, "Did the ship lose speed?" And he said, "Well, we were supposed to maintain a relatively slow speed there." So he didn't have any criticism, but he seemed to be the lone voice in the whole number of people I interviewed or tried to talk to about this. So it's clear that something was going on. The ship lost speed, and people got very angry. In fact, some British troops agreed to go down below and help. Some of them were miners, and they went down and wanted to deal with making sure that the coal fires were fed. So that was going on after that initial attack. And then the next day, the ship was still falling. It was still behind. And that's when it was attacked. The convoy was attacked again in greater force, and the ship was destroyed.
So, as you say, the ship is destroyed, and there's a lot more to the circumstances about that. We'll let people get into the book to read about the specifics of what's going on. But what is the legacy for you of the Empress of Asia? We talked at the start as to what captured your attention and why you wanted to write a book about it. But for anyone who's coming to the book, what is the legacy of it, and what is the importance or relevance of this story here in 2025?
Well, I guess for me, it's the legacy of the ship is the legacy of its people, of the legacy of the crew, the legacy of some of the lives that came and went. And I suppose overall, it's almost like a snapshot of one particular ship through a timeline. And I'm not pretending that it's, you know, the only story that's out there in terms of this type of thing. I wrote it because I wanted to sort of just try to give life to history, give a personal style of life to history through the people. The ship, I don't know, it's like many other ships. It just had that duty or that responsibility of ferrying people across around the world. It's certainly a time that I don't think we'll ever return to, but it's, I don't know, it just seemed important to me to describe a tumultuous period of history through eyewitnesses or people that experienced it, in this case on a ship. I don't go into a lot of things that they experienced once they left a ship, obviously, but it's more about, I suppose the story is about how those individuals, how that period of time impacted people, and how they adjusted, and how the ship was the way that conveyed them to where they needed to go. Personally, I mean, the Empress of Asia, I don't see the Empress of Asia as a great ship. I see the Empress of Asia as a ship that provided a service. It impacted people's lives. There's no doubt about that. Most of the people, especially the immigrants that came to Canada on her, including Lo Shu Hua, who was this Chinese woman I was mentioning, her family's never forgotten the name of the ship. It's part of their family lore. And I spoke to a number of people whose grandparents had come over, and all of them know about the Empress of Asia. it wasn't like in the family records, they just say, oh yeah, mom or grandma came over on a ship. It's very clear in most cases, they always say they came over on the Empress, they arrived on the Empress of Asia, or they'll say they arrived on the Empress of Russia, or just like the Titanic. I mean, the name of the ship was very, very important to people. And it's part of the, certainly family legacies.
Yeah, and you can really see it in the book that it's, yes, the ship, but the ship is a crossroads of a lot of different people. Yep. And that comes through very clearly. So again, the title is Oceans of Fate, Peace and Peril Aboard the Steamship Empress of Asia. Dan, if people want to check it out or check out, we've referenced one of the other books already, but you have multiple other books that people can go find. What's the best way for them to keep up with everything you got going on?
Well, the book, as I should mention, is published. This new one is published by Dundurn Press. I was previously with Lorimer, but I switched to jump ship, so to speak. But I'm on a different pub with a different publisher now, and it's available everywhere. It will be both nationally and internationally released on February the 18th. It's available both online, but also in large and independent bookstores. It'll be out there. We'll see how it does.
Well, we certainly hope it does well. We will link down below to the Dundurn Press page for it if you want to check it out. Again, releasing on February the 18th. So Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you very much, Sean. Appreciate the time, and it's good to see you again.
So there you have it, my chat with Dan Black, and I thank him for his time. And again, the book is Oceans of Fate, Peace and Peril Aboard the Steamship Empress of Asia, and it is available next Tuesday, February the 18th. So with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which comes from the Vancouver Sun, story by John Mackey entitled Historic Chinese Canadian Pacific Railway and Klondike Collections Unite in New UBC Museum. From April 23rd, 2024. And this is a story about the opening of this new collection at UBC, where people can go and visit this very extensive collection of Chinese and Canadian Pacific Railway artifacts. Phil Lind was one of Canada's top collectors of artifacts and memorabilia from the Klondike Gold Rush. And Dr. Wallace Chung is Canada's foremost collector of historic Chinese and Canadian Pacific Railway artifacts. So the article goes through and discusses some of the material that is in the collection that visitors can go see out there at UBC. But notably for me, as I was going through and looking at the article, there is a model of the steamship Empress of Asia that is floating in a new display. So the way it is set up in the museum makes it look like it is floating, and float in quotes there. It's not in water, but you can see the entirety of it. It's a beautiful model of what was, as Dan talked about, a beautiful ship. But what's really cool about this exhibit is that it places the steamship into the broader history, not only of the CPR, but certainly, of course, of Chinese Canadian history. So you get the sense in going through the article, which of course is linked below, but from those who have seen the exhibit, that it really places it into that very effective historical context of what the ship means for Chinese Canadian history and its place within that broader story. So would encourage you to check out the article. And certainly if you're out there in Vancouver and can get to this exhibit, would encourage you to do so out at UBC. So today's historical headline of the week from the Vancouver Sun on April 23rd, 2024 by John Mackey, Historic Chinese Canadian Pacific Railway and Klondike Collections Unite in New UBC Museum. And with that, I'll say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Like, rate, comment, all that good stuff. Helps other people find the show. Keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab, plus all of the great written material on the website. And then you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show. What's old is news at gmail.com. So thanks so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again next week for more What's Old is News.